U.S. senators of both parties have grilled top IRS officials this week over not being informed earlier about the tax agency's work to target conservatives, and they're demanding answers. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day. We'll ask our analysts to audit the questions being asked of the IRS, the answers they give, and explain why it matters. Our guests today, weighing in on this and other political developments, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday on the program today. And joining us are analysts Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. Tim Hagel is with us in our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hi to you, Tim.
Hey there.
Let's chew over some of the political developments we want to get to this hour and hopefully have our listeners join in. Note this number if you'd like to join in with a comment, a question, 1-866-780-9100. We'll be covering a number of topics today. New energy secretary, what does that mean for Iowa, considering our biofuel status, our wind energy status, third in the nation there? The freedom of the press, also in the spotlight, continuing this week with the Department of Justice actions. The politics of disaster relief. And also toward the end of the hour, Joyce Russell of Iowa Public Radio will join us to give us a view, perhaps the final stretch of the Iowa legislative session. And our analysts here will give us their views on what's happened this session and in our state's capital. But first, let's talk about testimony continuing on Capitol Hill. We heard news at the top of the hour of the lawmakers on Capitol Hill expressing, as we've seen in this testimony, Tim and Chris, anger, bewilderment that IRS leaders had not told Congress sooner about indications that the tax agency had improperly singled out conservatives and Tea Party groups seeking tax-exempt status. We just heard on our news, Lois Lerner, the IRS official in charge of the division, accused of wrongdoing, invoked her Fifth Amendment, her right to not testify. There. Yesterday, however, IRS officials faced tough questions from senators on the Finance Committee, including Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Senators are investigating claims that IRS officials charged with enforcing rules on tax-exempt status for nonprofit groups targeted conservative groups for the investigation. Here's an exchange about a specific instance in which an Iowa nonprofit complained about treatment by the IRS. This is Senator Charles Grassley and recently resigned IRS Acting Commissioner Stephen Miller.
Now, this comes directly from Iowa. One of my constituents attempted to establish 501c3 charity called Coalition for Life of Iowa. She told my staff that an IRS agent told her, quote, "Your application's ready to go. However, it will not be approved until you send a letter signed by your entire board under penalty of perjury, saying that you will not protest at Planned Parenthood." End of quote. Now, that's outrageous that that statement would be even made by anybody in government, that somehow you got to compromise your First Amendment rights. She also received a letter from the IRS asking several invasive questions, including the details of the group's prayer meeting. Now, stop to think about the government getting involved in somebody having a prayer meeting. It appears that the IRS essentially offered this group a quid pro quo. You can become a charity if you don't protest in front of a Planned Parenthood, generally speaking, so you don't have to worry about 6103. Is it appropriate even for an IRS employee to offer a quid pro quo in the example like this? Mr. Miller, or Mr. Shulman, either one of you.
The answer is no. I mean, We shouldn't be trading.
Okay, then let's move on. That's a good answer because that's the answer you ought to give. But how on earth could you let something like this happen under your leadership? And do either of you feel any responsibility or remorse for treating American citizen this way?
I think I started my public statement with an apology, sir, and I would continue that. I don't know what happened in your given case. And as you well are aware, I can't speak to it under the 6103 rules. But I do apologize for the treatment of folks. There are two things that happened with these cases. First was the selection, and the selection criteria was bad. Second was their treatment once they were in that group. And that, too, was bad, sir. It was. I don't know whether this particular organization was inside or outside of that group, but the service that folks got was not the service that we should be providing anyone. There's no question about that.
Recently resigned IRS Acting Commissioner Stephen Miller there in his discussion with Senator Grassley yesterday. Let me go to both of you for a reaction. Tim Hagel, to you first, listening to that one example and how Senator Grassley used it in this situation.
Yeah, and it's a real tough example because, as Senator Grassley noted, it's violating two provisions of the First Amendment, free speech and freedom of religion. And as much as, you know, this is coming from conservative groups, and so some liberals may, you know, be a little more dismissive of it. Liberals have also complained about this under prior Republican administrations. And so the IRS is a group that many people are very wary of. And so I think at a certain point, this is going to reach ahead of some sort. But of course, the question is to what extent any of these congressional committees can get the information that they need to find out if there was any actual wrongdoing or if they can find specific people on which to place blame.
Chris Larimer, what did you hear in that clip? What do you see in this testimony?
Well, I mean, the testimony is fairly brief, and I agree with Tim that it's difficult to predict. But I think more generally it's difficult to predict the political fallout from all of this, and I think there are a number of reasons for it. You know, we're obviously dealing with the acting commissioner, Stephen Miller, who has already resigned, and you've had other top-level resignations. But then the previous commissioner was appointed by a Republican president. You have... You know, there were Gallup polls last week that showed that, and this may have changed as the media covers the investigations and the hearings more, but that barely a majority of Americans are following the IRS stories closely or somewhat closely.
Mm-hmm.
You have probably the most loathed or hated government agency in the IRS being investigated by the branch of government that most people loathe or hate in Congress. And so, I think the political fallout from this is difficult to predict whether it's going to land on any one elected official.
Let's hear the IRS side of it. Well, let's go to Robert joining us in Cedar Rapids, because I think you have a question that pertains to that. Robert in Cedar Rapids, what's your take on the testimony that's going on in Washington over the IRS?
Well, thank you for taking my call. My question is, why is it inappropriate for the IRS to look at a group whose stated, I mean, even the name of their organization is that they don't like to pay taxes? They've named themselves after the Boston Tea Party. And so it seems like it would be logical for the IRS to give them a little more attention.
Okay, good question. Thank you, Robert. Tim, you want to tackle that? So the IRS is supposed to hold nonprofits to the rules that are there to govern their tax-exempt status. So why is it a problem to inquire about the degree of their political character?
Well, that in itself isn't necessarily a problem. That certainly if you're applying for tax-exempt status, that you have to meet whatever the criteria are. The problem here is how certain groups were selected for additional examination. And in particular, once those, as the clip that we played earlier indicated, former Acting Commissioner Miller indicated that once you're in that group, then some of the questions were rather invasive. And this is some of the things that Senator Grassley was reading off, and things like, well, what do you do in your prayer meetings? In other words, what's the content of your prayers? And so now you're violating that freedom of religion of the First Amendment, or telling you you can't go out and exercise your First Amendment right to protest. So that's the problem, is that it's not so much that these groups were given additional examination, but how they were selected to get that examination and then the extent of that examination.
Go ahead, Chris, and then I'll read something from John in DeSoto.
Well, and I think part of it also is that the public is upset by what they see with the IRS trying to sort of stop a movement in its tracks. So, you know, in 2010, the Tea Party movement really took hold. You saw big election gains across the country, not necessarily in Iowa, but in other parts of the country. And, you know, immediately the IRS started looking into some of these groups. And so I think the public is upset by what they see as sort of big government stepping in to sort of squelch any sort of movement before it even gets started.
Mm-hmm. John in DeSoto writes, he's listening to this conversation, "I think members of Congress from both parties are trying hard to make political hay. The IRS is an easy target. Everybody loves to dump on the IRS. Congress has cut funding for IRS while heaping more responsibility on them. Citizens United from the Supreme Court generated a landslide of applications for tax-exempt status. Some Republicans would like to use this crisis to justify their wish of fairer, flatter tax under the guise of tax reform," writes John, "which is, of course, a huge shift of taxes from wealthy to middle-class taxpayers. Their approach is to throw a wrench into the gears and then complain that the machinery is broken." Tim Hagel, what do you think of John's take on it?
Well, since you're sitting across me, you can see me shaking my head at that. That was an initial excuse that they said is that the there was an avalanche of applications, and in fact, that was not the case. And even if you have a situation where you had more applications or you had fewer staff to deal with whatever level of applications you had, that doesn't excuse singling out particular groups for this type of examination, which proved to be seems to be rather invasive. That what would happen if you just said, "Well, look, we don't have the staff for this." It would be more a matter of, well, people that should be getting looked at aren't getting looked at because we don't have the staff to do it, not, well, we're going to target this particular set of individuals or groups that are applying for a particular status.
Denise in Marion County writes, "Would you please have your guests comment on the little reported fact that Representative Issa was informed of the investigation into this matter in 2012? As supported by testimony given in a Senate hearing in the past few days, he continued to try to pin the White House with a cover-up charge when he knew about the situation in 2012. Do you know about that, Chris?
I've heard that mentioned before. I don't know much about the details, but I think that just speaks to the larger point about trying to predict the political fallout here, where, you know, initially it was the case where there was an attempt by Republicans, or at least it was made to be seen as Republicans would have an easy time with this as sort of putting this on the Obama administration. But when you start to have – you have the previous acting commissioner, a Republican appointee, if that's true about what Representative Issa knew in 2012, then I think, you know, the politics becomes difficult to predict, I guess I would say at this point.
It's hard to say you weren't informed when you were informed.
Right, exactly. And, and who gets blamed for this? If any elected officials get blamed, you know, I think that's going to be the real question. I think anymore it's starting to look like it's just going to be other IRS officials.
Tim Hagel.
Two quick things on that. As far as the whether ISA was informed, that I saw something along these lines too where the inspector general indicated that information had gone to the Hill, but it's always hard to say who it went to, whether ISA specifically saw, whether it was a staffer who didn't realize its importance and so forth. So, yeah, we need to know more about that as well. The other thing is that, yes, the prior Commissioner Shulman had been appointed by President Bush, but I saw today that apparently he was a Democratic donor. Mm-hmm. I don't know his full history, and I think that's something worth looking into beyond the fact that he was appointed by Bush.
Mm-hmm. Right, and to be fair, he said he had no knowledge of, mm-hmm. of these investigations during his time.
I want to pick up on your point there, Chris Larimer, about this having so many sort of dimensions of it, mm-hmm. that people don't seem to care about it. And I wonder if this is an issue that, as we hear testimony, is ceasing to have a black and white nature. It's having a lot of nuance here. Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand. Does that make it then a very difficult political weapon to wield if that is your aim, Chris?
Yeah, I think so. And honestly, I think it will fall away from the attention of the public. I mean, as I said, you know, if the Gallup poll still holds from last week where you have, you know, 54% roughly of Americans following this closely or somewhat closely, my guess is that as time goes on and it becomes more nuanced, you will see fewer and fewer Americans paying close attention to it.
Tim Hagel, you see it that way?
Yeah, I see that it's a possibility that it can go that way. On the other hand, I think that, as was indicated previously, because so many people are suspicious of the IRS to begin with, that it can be characterized fairly clearly as, look, the IRS is being intrusive beyond what is appropriate, mm-hmm. and that's something that probably can be used, particularly by Republicans. We'll see if Democrats get any traction out of it as well.
I don't know if we've heard it so much this week, but certainly last week we heard Nixon's name being thrown around, Watergate being thrown around. Any validity to that comparison, Tim Hagel?
Well, I think it's a little bit early to make those comparisons at this point in terms of what's going on. But certainly, yes, apparently last week was the 40th anniversary of the start of the Watergate hearings. And I actually can remember listening to those in high school. So it's a little bit different. We haven't gotten to that point yet. But on the other hand, there seem to be so many things that are coming all at once that it's certainly making it difficult for this administration.
And I think, you know, to follow up with that, I think it's difficult for the public to wrap their minds around, because right now we have bureaucrats acting badly, and people don't like bureaucrats anyway. And, you know, until we have, you know, pretty clear evidence of elected officials acting badly, I think it's going to be difficult to figure out where it goes.
Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us on this Politics Wednesday. We'd like you to join us. A number of topics we're tackling this hour. Maybe this is a good number to put on your fridge or wherever you are, perhaps at your workplace. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. When the mood strikes you, when a comment strikes you as good or you want to take issue with, those are the ways to contact with us live on the show. Let's go to other testimony on Capitol Hill yesterday. Apple CEO Tim Cook vigorously defending his company on Capitol Hill against charges that the tech company stashes billions of dollars overseas to lower its U.S. tax bill. That's after lawmakers released a report that found Apple had established overseas entities to help it bypass some taxes while exploiting U.S. loopholes that shielded about $44 billion from U.S. levies. Here is some of Cook's response to that questioning.
Apple has real operations in real places with Apple employees selling real products to real customers. We pay all the taxes we owe, every single dollar. We not only comply with the laws, but we comply with the spirit of the laws. We don't depend on tax gimmicks. We don't move intellectual property offshore and use it to sell our products back to the United States to avoid taxes. We don't stash money on some Caribbean island.
Vigorous defense there by Apple CEO Tim Cook yesterday. Tim Hagel, as we learn about this, we learn that corporations have been doing this for years, multinationals. Why is this now under such scrutiny? Why does it come to the fore at this point?
Well, part of it has to do with, again, the particular administration. The Obama administration always wants to have businesses and rich individuals pay more in taxes. Republicans generally want to provide often want to provide businesses with tax incentives to bring their business home and so forth. And so there's kind of a tug back and forth between Republicans and Democrats on these basic issues. And Apple, seen as maybe perhaps more progressive type company, that it sort of hurts them in a public relations sense to now be seen, well, you're not paying your fair share, to use that term, in taxes. But what this CEO or whatever his particular title was saying is basically, look, we've got investments in these places. And from their perspective, if they didn't have investments in those other places, they'd probably be getting some negative publicity in those places for saying, oh, you're coming in and, you know, we're selling product, but you don't have any investment here. So in that sense, they're spreading the wealth around a little bit. On the other hand, the fact that they're taking advantage of the tax laws, well, like any other company, they're entitled to.
Mm-hmm. How do you see politics shaping this, Chris Larimer?
Well, I think politics, I mean, part of it is it's just that it's Apple, and then nearly everyone owns some sort of Apple product. You know, as far as the public reaction to it, I don't think many people are going to pay attention to it. I mean, as long as Apple is still supplying a superior product, people are buying their iPhones, iPads, iPods, whatever it might be. You know, the public's not going to pay attention to this sort of investigation. It's not the type that's going to deter people from buying their product as long as they're still satisfied with the mm-hmm. product.
Hearing testimony from or comment from Rand Paul doing some of the questioning there, too, is taking the opposite. How dare you attack Apple, one of the world's and America's most successful corporations, coming to Apple's defense there? I think he said something like they should be issuing an apology and not lambasting them as they are doing here. I wonder, you know, if we have your thoughts, Tim and Chris, about being called to testify in Washington. Let me read just a few lines from a political article today to get your reaction to these. Congress used to be known for hauling cabinet officials, CEOs, and bureaucrats up to the Hill for public floggings. But these days, it's not so clear who's really on the hot seat. The new playbook for congressional witnesses is to punch back at lawmakers, a move with little risk since Congress is less popular than traffic jams. Tim Hagel.
And cockroaches. They're less popular than cockroaches as well.
Okay. We could make it like a nice list of things we don't like in our lives. Chris Larimer, your reaction to that. Is the nature of testifying in Washington changing? Do you see it here?
Yeah. It's hard to know. Maybe I don't watch enough congressional testimony, but I think a little bit. Certainly, elected officials are using it more and more, and I think maybe that's why it's changing on the part of those who are testifying, is because you see elected officials using it more and more as a way to publicize what they're doing. The Supreme Court hearings are a great example, and I know Tim knows a lot about this, but the way that, they're able to get their name out, if they're flamboyant, if they're aggressive and going after someone who's testifying, that gets on the news and they make more of a name for themselves. And now those who are testifying, knowing if they don't have, any sort of repercussions, they're able to fight back. Mm-hmm. I think it makes sense.
Jim is in Cedar Rapids. Before our break, we want to get you into the conversation. Hi, Jim. Jim Dowd, 1-866-780-9100.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Hey, I just got a real quick comment on the Apple tax story. I think the Apple official that was in your clip there was able to offer such a vigorous defense of Apple's practices there, because in fact they are complying with not only the letter but the spirit of the tax laws in both Ireland and the United States. I don't remember the exact verbiage, but Ireland's tax laws, favor companies that set up shop in Ireland but that are based in other countries favorably for taxes, and the U.S. doesn't assess taxes on companies that have offices in foreign countries. They leave that to that other country to assess the taxes. I think Apple certainly wasn't, working a scheme or a gimmick. I think the thing that it points out is there are gaping holes, massive holes in the tax laws as they exist today, and you don't really have to be criminal to drive a bus through them.
Right, and
in
fact, wouldn't Apple get rid of any accountant who didn't drive a bus through these gaping holes?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's really our tax code that's at fault if we decide it is, Tim Hagel.
Absolutely, and the way to look at this is one person's deduction is another person's loophole.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you see this as unfair, something that should be changed, Jim?
Well, I think it's – I wouldn't say that it's unfair because,
I mean, you or I can't do it, can we? We can't park our things in Ireland and get off without any
– I think the – our ability to exploit the the problems with the code doesn't necessarily mean that we're excluded from enjoying them if we could.
Okay, Jim, we have to go to a break. Thank you very much for bringing up that point. Jim in Cedar Rapids, dialed 1-866-780-9100. Politics Wednesday here. When we come back, we want to talk about the new energy secretary, being as Iowa has a unique place in our energy landscape. Also, the politics of disaster relief. Did you read who's now running for mayor of New York City? We'll talk about that as well. We hope you'll stay with us. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. Joining us, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, as we like to do most Wednesdays. We're chewing over developments on the political landscape and asking you to join us. 1-866-780-9100. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about the politics of disaster relief in light of that horrible tornado strike in Oklahoma. Also, a new energy secretary named, perhaps some implications there, and a new candidate declaring for the mayor of New York, that race there. Let's go, though, first to some local politics. The Iowa legislature, it's about 3 weeks, I believe, past its scheduled adjournment. joining us now from the Iowa State House to give us an update on some key sticking points, areas of attempted compromise. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, are you there?
I am. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Joyce. Thank you for joining us. If you could give us a quick overview of where we are on these 3 points being negotiated. I believe they are education, property tax, Medicaid expansion.
Right. Well, they struck a deal, as you probably know, on property taxes, sort of splitting the difference between the Senate Democrats' approach and the governor's approach. And that was announced last week. You know, there's a lot in there for Democrats not to like, so there's sort of an uneasy feeling that maybe the wheels might have fallen off of that. But, in fact, as we speak, they are now debating it on the floor of the Senate. This is a conference committee report, and so it can't be amended. I'm sure there will still be people get up and say what they don't like about it, but it looks like that the wheels are now well-greased for property tax reform. The big breakthrough to announce today is on education reform. After literally weeks of stalemate, they seem to have struck a deal, and it looks like the logjam has broken there.
Mm-hmm. And two contentious points there, I believe, if I remember, teacher evaluation and homeschooling, right?
Right, and they sort of split the difference on that as well. This is a wide-ranging bill, but it includes the sort of the centerpiece of the governor's plan, and that's a significant new money for schools to pay teachers more when they assume leadership duties outside the classroom, such as mentoring. So the bare bones of what the governor wanted on that is in the bill, but you're right, there were some more secondary issues that the two sides were fighting over, and Democrats have been sharply resisting the idea of a new system for evaluating teachers that took teacher test scores into account, and so the compromise has a commission to study that, and they may or may not study how teachers should be evaluated, and they may or may not include student test scores. So that was enough to get Democrats on board. To get the Republicans on board, they did get what they wanted on the homeschool issues, freeing homeschools from many, if not most, of state regulation, and allowing them to bring other kids besides their own kids into their homeschool classrooms. So it's a hybrid, but it looks like things are falling into place, and it looks like this is going to fly.
Well, let's talk briefly about give us an update on Medicaid expansion. Will the governor and the Iowa GOP agree to some sort of Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act? Under what conditions?
Well, I don't have any details, but the one of the chief negotiators on that is Representative David Heaton. He's a Republican in the House, and he was one of a handful of Republicans who could not go along with the governor's plan. He didn't necessarily agree with Medicaid expansion, but he also could not go along with the governor's plan for a more limited program covering fewer people. So he's been part of the negotiating, and he just about 10 minutes ago said they've reached an agreement, some kind of third way between expanding Medicaid and not expanding Medicaid, and he couldn't give me any details because then at this point in the session, you know, the negotiators have worked out these deals, but their first stop is to their individual caucuses to make sure that they've got enough votes and enough support on board. So it's too early for them to give details, but it certainly looks like they've come to some kind of compromise.
Okay, but you've given us a good overview on those 3 points. Let's
okay.
Before we say goodbye, tell us, you know, is adjournment in sight? Of course, the big question. You have to, even if you come to a compromise, this has to be worked through the machinery of the legislature, doesn't it?
That's right, and that's why some leaders were predicting that they would finish today. And I should mention that the same gentleman who told me about that they've got a compromise on Medicaid said they also have a compromise, and I, again, no details, but one of the other things holding things up is the Human Services budget has some abortion language in it, and that had slowed things down the last two sessions. Representative Heaton said that they've reached some kind of compromise on that, too. But so the big things seem to be falling into place, but you're right, it takes a certain amount of time just to move the paper and move the things through the process. And then the House, of course, has a rule that they don't debate, or they don't take votes after midnight. So I guess it's somewhat conceivable that they could finish this up today. I think not, but at any rate, the pieces are falling into place, and it looks like they're going to adjourn soon.
Okay, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, probably not holding her breath for adjournment, but waiting for it. We'll put it that way. Joyce, thank you for joining us legislature.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
You're welcome. Let's get your view on that after we got the latest update. Chris Larimer and Tim Hagel. Chris, go ahead. What is your comment on how this session is ending and what we'll end up with?
Well, it was nice to hear Joyce's comments because for the last week or two, it's been very difficult to track exactly what has been going on in the Iowa General Assembly. A lot of this has been going on behind closed doors. But from what Joyce said, it's sort of what we predict when we were back in January. Iowa is one of these few states that has a split legislature and a divided government as well. And so we knew it was going to be compromised, and it sounds like they've sort of divided down the middle on education reform and at least property tax reform. The education reform, the big hanging point there was on the teacher evaluations. And if they've moved past that and put it as this 3-year study, I believe now, I'm guessing that is going to pass and something will be done on education reform. It sounds like something will be done on property tax reform, although, as Joyce mentioned, a number of Democrats were pushing back on that a little bit because we've seen a lot of pushback from local governments with a concern about if they start rolling back property taxes, where are they going to be able to get the money to finance a lot of local government services? But it sounds like property tax, education reform will be done. I think what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, there's still a question about health care reform, whether or not that can actually get done during the session. So
it's not clear from what Joyce said if that's a yes or a no to the Obama administration.
Right, and you're talking about two very opposing points. I mean, you either expand Medicaid or you don't. I think it's hard to reach a compromise on that compared to something like education reform or property tax reform where you have more details to and different policies to play around with. And so my guess is that they'll pass education reform, property tax reform. As Joyce said, they still need to vote on the floor of both the House and the Senate before this goes forward. But if they want to get done this week, I would guess they would focus on those two issues and maybe leave health care reform to a special session.
Tim Hagel, a comment for you on the Iowa legislature before we move on to a couple of other items.
Yeah, not a whole lot to add from what Chris was saying. My one thought, though, is with education reform, as much as it may have gotten done that they've reached a deal, what's interesting is that it's leaving a lot open, and I think that may be the best way out of it at this particular point is to sort of say, okay, we're going to create a commission, but I think that what that commission comes back with in terms of recommendations, you may see this again if one side or the other is particularly displeased with what the commission recommends to evaluate teachers.
Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, and we're...
I wonder if I could follow up with
absolutely.
Tim,
before
with Tim
we move on, please do, Chris.
With the education reform, too, the more you think about it, we've seen a lot of pushback from, school superintendents about the delay in getting this education reform, and I wonder what their reaction is going to be if education reform is finally pushed through, if there's going to be some pushback to say, hey, we need to, in the future, let's try to get reforms done and let's try to figure out school funding formulas sooner.
Have enough headaches at
right.
that level of education. You don't need
right.
to have it created in Des Moines for all the school systems across the state. The politics of disaster relief, Chris and Tim, let's talk briefly about that. As emergency personnel and volunteers combed through the havoc left by the tornadoes that tore through Oklahoma on Monday, killing many people, they are going to rely on critical federal funding that was severely cut by these massive cuts we have come to call sequestration. President Obama declaring a state of emergency for Oklahoma, directing federal aid for the state and local recovery. Here he is speaking on Monday, I believe.
As a nation, our full focus right now is on the urgent work of rescue and the hard work of recovery and rebuilding that lies ahead. Yesterday, I spoke with Governor Fallon to make it clear to Oklahomans that they would have all the resources that they need at their disposal. Last night, I issued a disaster declaration to expedite those resources to support the governor's team in the immediate response and to offer direct assistance to folks who have suffered loss. I also just spoke with Mayor Lewis of Moore Oklahoma to ensure that he's getting everything that he needs. I've met with Secretary of Napolitano this morning and my Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor, Lisa Monaco, to underscore that point, that Oklahoma needs to get everything that it needs right away.
President Obama speaking yesterday, not Monday. I misspoke there. So how is the President Obama in those remarks not mentioning budget cuts, not mentioning sequestration? So how is the tornado disaster likely to impact negotiations over the budget, efforts to actually improve on a budget, Tim Hagel?
Well, let me first say that certainly to answer your direct question, that's not the point for President Obama to be talking about budget things, as much as that may be something that will be discussed thoroughly. And I see
the day after such a disaster.
Actually, even 2 hours after the thing hit, people were talking about whether the senators, Oklahoma senators Inhofe and Coburn, would they be complaining about offsets and things like that. So even before we knew how serious the damage was, some people were trying to make it a political issue. But certainly for the president to come out, that's not the point. And if he had made it a political issue right then, he would have been roundly criticized, if only by the right, but perhaps from some other folks as well. But it is an issue, and it's the kind of a thing where, okay, we need to have money, the federal government needs to have money for these types of emergency situations, but on the other hand, they also have to be responsible in paying for it. At least that's what the Republicans would argue, and so that's why we'll see what kinds of things, what kinds of bill will appear. And just on that particular point, one of the sticking points in the Sandy relief bill was the amount of pork that was lauded onto it. And so if you can get a relief bill that doesn't have that on, you're more likely to get a lot of Republicans to vote for it.
We remember that those hard feelings about the relief for Hurricane Sandy victims. New York Representative Peter King yesterday saying he's willing to overlook what he calls the hypocrisy of lawmakers who opposed aid for the his state in the Northeast in the wake of Superstorm Sandy. But he's going to overlook that and might support funding for tornado-stricken Oklahoma, predominantly a Republican area. Chris, your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, regarding the politics of disaster relief, the difficulty is that, you know, what is the constituency for disaster relief? Well, it's potentially anybody and nobody. And, you know, when you think about trying to get funding for a particular project, you need a well-mobilized group that's able to lobby lawmakers. Well, you don't know what the group is going to be until the disaster strikes. And when the disaster strikes, you're talking about a low probability, high cost event. And that's, you know, that's something that's difficult to budget for. That's something that's difficult to find support to budget enormous amounts of money for. So I think that's, you know, it's not surprising, I guess, that FEMA was on the chopping block when the sequester went through.
Of course, here in Iowa, we're worried about disasters, tornadoes, of course, as well, also of flooding. Anything can be said specifically about the relevancy of the debate in Washington in light of this tornado for Iowa communities as we start tornado and flood season?
I don't know. I think it's difficult to say what's going to happen. I don't think there's going to be any immediate consequences with Iowa. It's just going, unfortunately, it's probably going to take some sort of disaster, whether it's flood or tornado, to see what the financial effect will be for Iowa.
A few other things to pick up here. As of yesterday, we have a new energy secretary, Ernest Moniz. He is his swearing in comes in with a backdrop of this ongoing natural gas boom here in the United States. Also, we here in Iowa, the third biggest producer of wind energy among the 50 states, and we are, as we've reported in the last few days, breezing into significant new wind energy investment, not to mention being a leading producer of biofuels such as ethanol. Tim Hagel, sorry about that that remark about breezing. Your thoughts, though, on where energy policy is now and where it's heading here in Iowa?
Well, the new secretary indicated that he's in favor of President Obama's all-of-the-above approach. Now, certainly some on the right would suggest that maybe they really aren't interested in all of the above, but to the extent that that includes wind energy and biofuels of various sorts, then that certainly puts seems to bode well for Iowa in terms of its approach to these this emerging market here in Iowa. So we'll have to see. As far as the natural gas issue is concerned, though, it's an interesting issue because It's seen as, I think the Secretary said, it's a bridge kind of fuel to wean us off the carbon-based fuels. But on the other hand, apparently environmentalists are very unhappy with the fracking that is also often associated with it. So, you know, in one sense, it's good from the reducing carbon emissions perspective, but on the other hand, you've got the concerns of environmentalists, so it's going to be an interesting issue to see how that shakes out.
Chris?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's still a little bit early to tell, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised to see Iowa lawmakers in Washington talking to the new energy secretary about things like the ethanol credit, the wind credit, things that have come up and have been controversial in the past, to see those things continued and make sure that they get his ear early on and often to make sure that those stay in place, because they are clearly beneficial to the state.
Let's touch on this before we have to say goodbye for this Politics Wednesday. A couple of weeks ago, we saw the political comeback of a former North Carolina Governor Mark Sanford when he won a congressional seat in a special election. Today, we find out former Representative Anthony Weiner from New York jumping back into politics, announcing a bid for the mayor of New York City. We recall Weiner's career in public life when it came to an abrupt end, when he sent some lewd pictures to a college student via Twitter. And let's listen to Anthony Weiner now announcing his candidacy for mayor of New York with this ad.
Every day starts right here. And it's the best part of my day.
All right. Are we gonna put this?
And then you step outside, and New York's like no other place. This was my neighborhood growing up, a middle-class kid in Brooklyn. I thought we had it all, playing stickball late into the night. And if we were lucky, a Mets game on the weekends. I went to PS 39. My mom was a school teacher for 31 years in public schools just like this. My dad went to law school on the GI Bill and then hung a shingle outside our house. Theirs is the classic New York story. You work hard, you make it into the middle class, and you make life a little bit better for your kids. That's how this city was built, but it's getting harder and harder every day. Some of the highest rents in the country went up 20% the last 2 years alone. And you want to buy? It'll cost you $1 million. Good jobs with benefits? Disappearing. Our schools aren't what they should be. And we need to keep this city safe. And if you're trying to run a business on a neighborhood shopping strip like this one, you're drowning in regulations that nickel and dime you to death. The very people that put everything they had into this city are getting priced right out of it. But it doesn't have to be that way. In Congress, I got $1 billion to put more cops on the beat. Fought to get sick 9/11 first responders the help they deserve. Led the campaign for real health reform that regular people can afford. We can make a difference if we're willing to fight for it. Look, I made some big mistakes, and I know I let a lot of people down. But I've also learned some tough lessons. I'm running for mayor because I've been fighting for the middle class and those struggling to make it my entire life. And I hope I get a second chance to work for you.
Okay. Anthony Weiner announcing his candidacy for the mayor of New York with that ad there. We wanted to hang on to that ad to hear the contrition, the apology, which was actually more than a minute into that announcement there. Chris Larimer, the likelihood of a political rebirth of this scandal-tainted figure in politics?
Well, given what happened with former Governor Sanford, I guess I'm no longer surprised about the ability of a politician to come back. But I thought that that commercial was interesting because you had, you know, him starting off talking about being a lifelong New Yorker, this uplifting song, you know, very humble background, all these problems that he can solve, and that he's going to look out for the average New Yorker, and then kind of, oh, by the way, I made some huge mistakes in the past if you weren't at all following the news a few years ago. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Certainly it worked with Mark Sanford. So.
Mm-hmm. And here in this video, we didn't hear the part. I think she speaks in it later. Anthony Weiner's wife, also mm-hmm. longtime Hillary Clinton aide, appears in the video and endorses her husband's run. Tim Hagel.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly important. Of course, that didn't happen with Mark Sanford, and he still managed to win in South Carolina. So with Weiner's wife still there, basically, if she forgives him, then other people probably need to as well. But on the other hand, we just have to wait and see if he can convince enough people to do it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we're in a new era of political comebacks, or if this matches up with what we've seen in decades prior to this.
Well, in prior, no, I don't think that we've seen quite as much of this in the past, where if somebody had this sort of a personal, even a personal scandal, as opposed to one that's more political, that it would have pretty much left them out. But these days, it seems people are perhaps more forgiving, or at least the people that are willing to own up to their mistakes and say, okay, I've learned, as Wiener said, I've learned my lesson. It's a tough lesson, and I'm a better man for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have just a few seconds left. Anything happened this week that you want to get out there, Chris or Tim, before we go? What will you be looking forward to in the next coming week?
I guess as far as things happening as a Chicago Bears fan, I'm a little upset that Urlacher officially retired. But, okay. you know, as far as things, I mean, certainly watching the Iowa legislature to see what happens, which of the three issues is resolved and which one's left for a special session.
Chicago Bears and Iowa legislature, we'll hope which one has priority.
That's
but
right.
We'll
That's
go,
right.
Tim, quickly for to you.
I just want to see what's going to happen with the various Washington-based scandals with we didn't get a chance to touch on it, with the DOJ spying on journalists, with the IRS. Since the Benghazi stuff, which hasn't gone away yet either.
Right. That was the big trio of controversies that took flight last week. Thank you very much. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. A pleasure to have you both on our show. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton, and in Cedar Falls. Help from Tony Daner, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. Help also from Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.